Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 4 of Path of the Sober Seeker. My name is James. I'm an alcoholic, and I'm going to be your host for today. We're going to start out every episode, as we always do, with Al-Fatiha. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim, Alhamdulillahir Rabbil Alameen, Ar-Rahmanir Rahim, Maliki Yawmiddin, Iyyaka Na'budu wa Iyyaka Nasta'in, Ihdina Sirata Mustaqim, Sirata Ladina An'amta Alayhim Ghayril Maghdubi Alayhim Wadallain. Amin. And welcome everyone to the show. Today, I'd like to introduce our guest. We have a very special guest today. His name is Rich. He is a... let's go ahead and do it. Rich, why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself today?
Hi. Yeah, I'm Rich. I am an artist. I'm an artist. Spiritual artist.
Absolutely.
Let's put it that way.
So do you find when you're like a creative flow like that, like art, I mean, do you have like... talk me through your process, man. I'm not an artist. I don't know what...
It develops. It's constantly developing. I've dabbled in many different mediums, like oil paints. My main thing is airbrush, though. And I think it has a lot to do with the fact it relates a lot to, or it's very similar to tattooing. Like, I price it the same as the tattoo artist would. I found that a lot of creative people fall into, they come out of school, and the way society's set up, you go get a job and you do this and you do that. And unless you, if you go to, like, I went to college for commercial art, and it was not my thing. So I freelance. But as it pertains to spirituality, I found myself creating these, I often wonder, I create these monstrous kind of helmets, I have a couple that I've made, and I look at them and I'm going like, wow, these are really demonic. So how does that translate into a spiritual, a godlike existence? And I convinced myself that when I made those things, those ugly things, and people have asked me, how can you claim to be godlike and still make these sort of demonic looking helmets, and these, your art is kind of dark. There's a lot of fire and a lot of that gothic sort of, that kind of thing that interests me. But the way I looked at it, or the way I justified it in my head, was that the demons in my mind, the demons that I battle every day, manifest themselves in some shape that I'm creating when I'm in that creative space. And when they manifest themselves, I look at it like it's trapped. I trap this demon. There it is.
Oh, like a Ghostbusters trap. Like they put the little box
exactly,
out.
Exactly. Oh, exactly. Okay. Only it comes through me and it manifests into a materialistic thing. So it's not that ghostly thing that's haunting me, right?
Oh, that's fascinating.
It's a material thing that I can take and put on a shelf and I don't have to deal with it anymore.
Yeah, I was about to ask you, because I know you do different mediums of art. We spoke a little bit. You do, boat airbrushing. You do a lot of work with the motorcycle community.
Sure, sure.
Do you find that that's just what sells, or is it just what comes out when you're being creative for creativity's sake?
I don't know. I kind of fell into it because, well, I didn't fall into it. I kind of moved into that area because I know those people,
Okay.
I ride, and so I know a lot of guys that ride, and when I was in the islands, I knew a lot of people on boats, and then there was a biker community there. I gravitate towards those kind of people. I gravitate towards the rebellious outcasts of society, I guess.
More of the unconventional.
Right.
Well, that's one of the things we deal with in recovery. I've talked about in the rooms how we're the, for lack of a better term, the island of misfit toys.
Mm-hmm.
And, we talk about that. It says specifically in the big book that we're people who normally would not mix.
Right.
And I think that's a very important distinction, considering like the disease of addiction, it respects no one. It doesn't care what color your skin is. It doesn't care what you do for a profession. It doesn't care about anything.
Right.
Yet it's going to take everything.
Right.
And I think because it's such an all-encompassing disease that respects nothing. we, you know, when we come into recovery and we're seeking that type of healing, you know, obviously we're going to come from all the different backgrounds that kind of, you know, reflects that level of disrespect that the disease has. It's just another one of those contradictions of recovery.
Right.
One of the things, and one of the reasons I wanted to ask you on the show today was we were, you know, I was at a meeting the other night and you had mentioned that that one comment has just been in my mind all week, the one about how, you know, we fall into structure, and when you break out of that comfort zone, that's really what allows a higher power, God, to work in your life. And it's just been, I've been like really, you know, not to give too much away about my personal, you know, situation, but, you know, about my injury and what, you know, I've been sidelined these last few weeks, and it's really been a total disruption to my routine, like a total, you know, disruption. But at the same time, it's opened the door for me to not only work on this podcast, but other, you know, I have a big chunk of time to invest and to put in all these other projects that are, you know, making a sincere contribution. So one of the things, and I kind of wanted to explore that a little bit with you. I want to talk about like good structure versus destructive structure, you know, and in AA, we have a, you know, it is a very structured progression. You know, we have different, you know, the steps are there for a reason. The traditions are there for a reason. You know, we do, you know, we do what we can to avoid innovation. And the traditions are there to ensure continuity among different groups. I know you're a well-traveled guy and you've been to meetings all over the world. And it's like when you go in, it's the same structure in every meeting. And we apply that to our, you know, our recovery. We have like healthy structure versus what happens like when you cross into an unhealthy structure where you're involved in maybe a, you know, thought patterns, behavior patterns that might not necessarily be relapse, but they're still, you know, destructive mentally and destructive emotionally.
Right, right. What do I do?
Or just what, I mean, just any insight you would have.
Well, I know complacency is dangerous, right?
Right.
So, I really admire what you've done with yourself with this podcast, and I think that's what attracted me to you. You know, you say you were driving truck and you had your injury, and now it gives you time for this. And the first thing that came to my mind is when one door closes, God'll open another one.
Right.
But you have to be aware of when that door opens, and that's the tricky part. It's like, is this the right thing for me to do? It's a good example from me is, you know, when I was living in the island, I made that my home. I didn't want to live anywhere else. In fact, to this day, I really don't want to live anywhere else. I want to be in a tropical climate. I miss it horribly. I miss it terribly. But when I was there, I learned a lot about myself. I learned that and I might get a little off topic here, but what I learned was that I didn't have the tools, the life tools to fit in where I wanted to be, right? And in the course of the time living there, you know, that's where I got sober. And during that time, I didn't take it seriously. I didn't take sobriety seriously. I didn't take the things that were good for me seriously. I wanted them, but I didn't know how to get there myself. And I've always got there myself through my whole life. It was me pushing through, working hard, trying to do the best that I can at whatever was in front of me at the time. And I think all of that led me to here. So when I was there in the islands and I'm trying to get sober and I'm the only thing I had was my own self-will, my own, what I've learned from life up to that point. Now I'm 40 at that time, and I have these people trying to help me. And in the past, the people that were trying to help me, I felt judged by those people, like, you have a problem and you need to fix it. That's what I heard. But what I saw was somebody that had the same problem telling me that I have a problem and I need to fix it. And I'm like, how do you know? You know, I mean, this is what we've always done. How do you know I have a problem if you're doing the same thing? Right?
Right.
So is this normal, or are you just singling me out, making me, you know, trying to make me feel inadequate, which I did. But I didn't know any of that until I got sober, until I worked the 12 steps and got into that personal inventory where I started looking at the things that made me mad throughout my history of life, essentially, those things that I was harboring, that I was hanging on to, that anger and resentment. Once I started looking at those and I was able to see through the process where they came from, when they started, I was able to see how I could correct them. And in that process of self-discovery, people were offering suggesting certain books to me. You know, we talked about Emmett Fox's Sermon on the Mount. Right. And when I read that book, all the confusion from the time I was a little kid up until that point, all the confusion that I experienced was clarified in Emmett Fox's book, Sermon on the Mount. And I'm like, so that's what Jesus is talking about? And it was so simple. It was so common sense in a way.
Right.
And it's funny how people will take their understanding and try and influence you with it. And that's what I felt like what was going on through my life. People were trying to influence me or convince me of their perception of religion or God or whatever. And I didn't trust it. I didn't trust what people were offering me, right? Or
right.
Trying to tell me, because they were telling me, you need to do this. When I went to Alcoholics Anonymous, they never told me that. They said, you know, in fact, the men that helped me, they said, we'll never tell you what to do. We'll only show you what we did to get to where we're at.
Right.
You know, and I worked with a guy like that one time. He never told me how to do the job. He showed me what to do. And I was like, man, that's how we should be communicating with people in life. I mean, if you look at the broad spectrum of what's happening in the world, everybody's telling everybody what they should be doing and what they need to be doing. Nobody's showing anybody how to do it properly, or at least there are very few. I mean, I've seen people who say, you know, this is the way it's done, and if you don't do it this way, you don't get the benefits of that. And you see that a lot in AA.
Right.
Right. You see, well, this is what we did. If you don't do what we did, you're not going to get what we have. And this goes back to when I first got sober. I didn't know what they had. I had no idea. I knew they told me, you know, find somebody who has what you want and ask them to be your sponsor, right?
Right.
I found the guy who had the car, the girl, the house, the business, the boat, the bike. You know, I'm like, he's got everything I want. I'm going to ask this guy.
Like worldly stuff.
Worldly stuff.
Right.
I was totally oblivious to the spiritual. And that, now that I'm older and been around a little while, that's the thing that I want most. That's the thing that I find myself pursuing more than anything, the material or anything, is the spiritual aspect of life. You know, that communication with God, that constant, conscious contact,
right,
that they talk about, you know, and that's, to me, that's the most important thing, and it's the guiding thing in my life. If God wants me to be rich, I'll be rich. If God wants me to be a poor beggar, whatever God's
starving artist,
a starving artist, there you go.
Right.
If He wants me to be that, then I need to be that to the best of my ability, to glorify Him. Right.
Right.
So. If I'm so that's kind of my life on a daily basis, to try and be the best rich that rich can be. You know what I mean?
Oh, absolutely. That's kind of the function of the steps is we become the best version of ourselves. I mean, you look at, you know, 6 and 7, where we're getting rid of character defects. We're doing, you know, clearing up our wreckage, making amends, doing all these different things to, you know, basically, you know, clear off all the crud
and
become the best version of ourselves.
Right, right.
It's just with, I feel like in AA or just, you know, recovery in general, it doesn't necessarily, you know, it's not, AA isn't the end all. You know, there's other fellowships, there's other things, but we are, because of the wreckage of our lives, because we lived with that sense of like selfishness and self-centeredness for so long, and we had such in-your-face consequences, you know. Right. And every single one of us has a different, you know, has a different rock bottom. We've all had a different, you know, different story. But the fact is we have been brought to our lowest of low from, you know, from this disease. And since we have experienced that sense of like spiritual, you know, rock bottom, we have a launching pad to launch up. Mm-hmm. And two, it gives us a sense of gratitude once we do start to get, you know, clear away some of that wreckage and start to live, you know, and start to allow the light of Allah or a light of God into your heart.
Right.
It's just really, you know, but it's something that the entire world can benefit from. And mm-hmm. you mentioned earlier in your comment that it's like you see, you know, out in the world, everyone's like, oh, you should do this, you should do that, all these other things. And everything is trying to dictate your reality to you. Mm-hmm. Whereas in the rooms, you don't have any of that. You have people who say, okay, if you do what I do, you know, you might get a sense of it.
Right.
But it's not guaranteed. You know, because everyone's story is different. You're sure. not guaranteed. I mean, just because you get you see someone who has something you want, all the material things, the boat, the sponsor, the big house, all that, you're not guaranteed that. But like you mentioned earlier, you're guaranteed to have that relationship with your higher power.
Sure.
And that opens you up to being content with the destiny, the one that's written for you. You know, in AA, we call it the road to happy destiny.
Sure.
In Islam, we call it al-Qadr, which is the divine decree. It's actually one of our six articles of faith that you believe in the destiny that has been written for you.
Sure.
And you have a sense of provision. You know, and everything's written for you and being at peace with that. And that's one of the things that really, you know, comes along with it. But it's very difficult when we live in such a materialistic society, when they're saying, okay, well, you need to make X amount of dollars a year. You need to have this car. You need all these different things or you're never going to be happy.
Right.
And it's programmed from a younger age too. Like if you think back in school, like you, you know, I understand you're an artist, you're more of a creative soul. And, the powers that be or the structure of society doesn't like things like that. They don't want people who think outside of the box, who color outside of the lines. They want you to toe the line. You know, you're supposed to pay attention in school, get all this knowledge regurgitated on a test, sit still under fluorescent lights for 8 hours a day, you know, go to college and really kick it in. And then if you don't do that, if you don't follow it, then you're going to end up broke and lonely. And they try to structure everything with fear. You know, and it's really...
Well, there is truth to that, for sure,
right.
As far as structuring with fear. You know, I'm not man enough if I don't drink this kind of... The girls won't like me if I don't do this. And if I don't drive this car, I'm not going to be this person. And there is some truth to that. I mean, society-wise, there's truth to that. You know, people are influenced by what they see through the media, through off the internet, and there's social media stuff. People are influenced. I know I was influenced by television my whole life. A lot of the reason I'm on the bikes is because I was a big Fonzarelli fan. Arthur Fonzarelli, Happy Days, he was the coolest guy, right? Speed Racer, that's why I like cars, custom and old cars. I used to I couldn't wait to watch Speed Racer. I was into comic strips. And I can see through my life where these TV shows and cartoons and such influenced my direction in life. It's weird how that happens. Actually, it's a little bit scary because I can step back and try and view the bigger picture, and I can see how media influences people. If how the everything you see on TV and the internet and your news channels, how it influences people. You got the whole left, right thing going on. You have all these hot topic issues in the world today, and how they get fueled by social media. The thing is, through my experience, I've been out in public, and when you're not in front of a computer or a television or things like you put your phone down for a minute, when you're out in public, and depending on where you are, you don't see any of that. You don't see it. If you can get away from that influence and talk to people directly, of course, maybe it's because all I do is go to meetings, right?
Right.
But when I lived in the islands, some of the happiest, most loving people that I've ever met were the poorest, were the people who weren't influenced by materialistic things. They wanted you know, they wanted a nice life, but they were happy with where they were. And I see that here as well. I mean, Ohio, it's just in Northeast Ohio, but anywhere around a large, something going on?
Yeah.
Yeah, not understand. I just any major city, any major, any metropolitan area, people are so wrapped up in their day to day. You know, I have to go to work. I have to make this money so I can pay my mortgage and my insurance and my health care. And I have to do this. And it's like, to me, it's a trap. And to me, it feels like a trap. That's why I live and work the way I do. I have more freedom in. Where my, you know,
your energy and attention are going.
Yeah.
Determination.
Right.
No, I feel it is a trap, you know, and it's by design. Like our society has been engineered this way to keep people trapped. I mean, because they're not, I mean, when you have a population that is so focused on day-to-day survival, you know, and at this day and age, most people aren't getting ahead. I mean, you look at like how, you know, rent prices have increased, food prices have increased, insurance, cars, fuel, everything costs so much. And so many people have to work so hard. You know, you have multiple jobs. They're doing side gigs, you know, DoorDash, Uber, whatever, just to make ends meet. A society that is that distracted just with day-to-day survival isn't going to cause trouble. You know, they're too tired at the end of the day.
Right, right.
The Romans figured it out. They used to keep their people, you know, with bread and circuses. These days we have McDonald's and the NFL.
Right.
So it's like they're not, you know, no one's talking about anything really, that's going to cause trouble. It's not going to like shake the roots of society. They're just so, you know, wrapped up in day-to-day survival.
Sure.
And it's getting, you know, it's getting worse. You know, I see with, take the legalization of marijuana, for example. Mm-hmm. Okay, like I was a big, you know, I used that, one of my favorite, you know, escapes when I was in active addiction. And one thing about using that substance is it makes you okay with being lazy.
Yep.
So you have an entire population that is now, you know, partaking in that type of thing.
Sure.
So in their off time, they're just doing that, you know, watching SportsCenter or whatever. They're not going to be out in the streets protesting. And I see this, like I go on, Twitter or look at different like international, forums, and people in Europe especially can't understand why Americans are so just so complacent, just so docile in the face of being, you know, taken advantage of by our government, taken advantage of by employers, taken advantage of by just the oligarchy and the ruling class. It's because they're too comfortable. And that's the thing where we can, you know, to bring it back into that sense of like being caged by comfort. And it's not necessarily I'm not trying to advocate for like, you know, social unrest or like anarchy or anything. But when we're so wrapped up in day-to-day survival, there's very little energy that you could put towards self-improvement. Mm-hmm. When you're living and putting all of your energy into just satisfying the needs of what we call the dunya, you know, the world, there's very little extra attention to give to the divine. And that's really what opens up our hearts. And that's one of the things like in Alcoholics Anonymous, where if I'm going to meetings at night, I'm not sitting at home just watching TV, not just consuming all this media. I'm actually out, you know, being part of the community, being, you know, interacting with people. And it's good for all of our spiritual well-being.
Yeah, well, it boils down to what you put in to your – what you consume is what you're going to put out or what you're going to put out or where your focus is going to be. So what you consume – so what I was talking about, how these movies and TV shows influenced me through my life. If you're consuming a large amount of dark material, entertainment wise, like if you're a horror flick fan, you know, and I'm not saying there's anything wrong with horror flick fans, a horror movie is fun once in a while, but if that's all you do and all you obsess about, it's going to twist your mind, you know.
Right.
It's the same with music. If I'm amazed at how impactful music is on me. You know, certain types of music, like this hard head banging, rah, 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 how that, I mean, that just gets me, I get, you know, I get on edge, you know. Right. If I'm listening to it while I'm driving, road rage is there. It's lives there, right? If I'm listening to some cool old bluesy stuff, then yeah, man, I start get melancholy, you know. I start thinking about my old girlfriends and certain things, and it's I'm allowing that thing, those things to influence me, right? And today I don't do it out of habit or do it to feel good. I do it when I listen to those types of music that I listened to when I was a kid. It's usually I'm quiet, I've got a piece of artwork going on, and I need some stimulation to push that creativity forward, right? That's really the only time I listen to music. I don't listen to it in my truck while I'm driving. I don't listen to, I'm not on my phone very often because I don't want to cut off that connection I have with God, you know? And if I'm distracting myself with these things, the computer, the TV, the radio, then I'm cutting myself off from God. Now, if I'm thinking about, if I'm connected to God and I'm like, is there a message in this entertainment that I'm consuming right now that can affect my life in a positive way? I'm going to look at it, you know, like if I'm reading a book or I'm watching a podcast or I'm, you know, I've got something going on in the background while I'm, you know, what am I getting out of this? If it's hateful and hurtful music, then I need to turn that off. And I will. I forgot where I was going with that.
It's okay. You brought up an interesting point. It's like if you find yourself doing that, I feel like working a program of recovery gives us the tools we need to have that, you know, that sacred pause, that moment of self, you know, introspection where you're like, hey, wait a minute, why am I feeling this way? We kind of take the, 10,000 foot view and say, okay, what is going on? We pause in the moment. Sure. It gives us one of those tools that aren't, most of society doesn't have that, mm-hmm. Doesn't have that.
You hit it right there on the head. Most of society doesn't have that.
Right.
And it's interesting that we do, where it came from and how it developed. I mean, it's such a small part of the global community, our little program, right? Alcoholics Anonymous.
Right.
It sort of illustrates how they say, I've heard it said in the Christian community that, you know, the path to God is narrow and the path to hell is wide, and if you step back and look at the global community, I can see how that would be, you know. Or even if you look at it from the perspective of Alcoholics Anonymous, and Alcoholics Anonymous, the reason I like Alcoholics Anonymous, or why I'm so into it, is that, number one, what we talked about, nobody tells you what to do in Alcoholics Anonymous. They show you what they did, and that's the way it's supposed to be. There's a lot of humility with this program. There's a lot of spiritual guidance through this program that was developed through, you know, so many people that have gone before us. This program is developed through their experience. You know, everything right. that is that exists in this program today is a direct result of somebody else's experience who've gone before us. And that is just on a large scale what I think God wants of us. You know, you set a good example, you learn your lessons, and you pass it on to somebody else. If they want it, they'll use it. If they don't, then they need, you know, there's more for them to learn before they get to that point.
Right.
That's why the 12 steps are in order for a reason. That's what they tell us. They're in order for a reason. You got to establish that relationship with God to help you understand yourself in 4 and 5, where your defects are and where your character is in general. And then in 6 and 7, we work with God on these defects, right? And then in 8 and 9, we make set things right. That's why the 9th step promises they can make those promises, because right. in that step, we're painstaking about that phase of our development, right?
Right.
So we're paying back the money. We're changing our behavior. We're, you know, we're spending time with our kids and our taking care of our people, right? So, of course, those promises are going to come true. Fear of financial insecurity will leave us. Why? Because we paid back the money. Fear of people will leave us. Why? Because we're better people, and we attract better people, and we've set the wrongs right with the people that we've wronged, you know?
Right.
And then at 10, 11, and 12, what do? We continue to do those first nine on a daily basis. It breaks it down. We continue to do an inventory because none of us are perfect. You know, I have new character defects pop up all the time. And 11, we continue to improve that conscious contact with God as we understand him, or, and you know, whatever your concept of God is. And then at 12, what do? We're of service. We're of service to God and our fellow man, right?
No, I agree.
And where else can we be that, be more effective in that service than in a place where we can identify with other people like us, right?
Absolutely.
And I know from my own experience, it was super hard for me to identify with a certain level of society that I found myself in when I moved to those islands, you know? These people, and maybe it was my own perception, my own insecurities that excluded me from those people, but I saw successful, well put together people. And when I say well put together, I'm not talking about just their clothes. I'm talking about their lives were well put together. They built nice lives for themselves. And that intimidated me, and I'd never been intimidated like that before. It made me feel less than. And today I understand that I didn't need to feel that way. All of that feeling that I felt inadequacy was a direct result of my defects of character, my self-loathing, my low self-esteem. And until I could work on that, I'll never fit in a situation like that I found myself in. I wanted to so bad. I wanted to be those people, but I didn't have the proper training. So today I found that it's not important to be part of that. What's important is to be the best version of myself, so that when I find myself in situations that might be intimidating to other people or the old me, it's okay.
Right.
I am who I am, and I'm constantly learning and constantly growing. And if I'm not good enough for your clique, your group, or whoever you are, that's cool too, man. I'll just move on and do my own thing.
Right.
Because today I'm comfortable with me. And that's what it boils down to, I think. I'm comfortable with me, and I'm comfortable with my relationship to God. And I know that if I keep doing what I'm doing, that relationship will grow and improve. And, you know, I've already found my people. I found my people in Alcoholics Anonymous.
Right.
I
want to touch on something you mentioned earlier about how AA, we do represent such a small, I guess, contingent of the global community, which is true. You know, I've often said that AA, we're the biggest secret society in the world, though. You know, we have our own way of recognizing each other. You know, we're a friend of Bill's. Mm-hmm. You know, we have, you've seen the triangle inside of the circle. You know, just a little, sure. That's all it takes is just one tiny little symbol on the back of a car somewhere, and you know that's a friend.
Yeah.
And, you know, we have our own language. Uh-huh. We do. We have our own way of recognizing each other. We have our own language, and it's, you know, I feel that it's, you brought up a good point that when you were involved in a certain like level of, you know, society, these people who seem to, you know, normal, well-adjusted people who might seem intimidating, and to come from, a lot of us in AA, we come from a very, I grew up in a very psychologically tumultuous, you know, environment, and it's common for a lot of us, you know, sure. We use drinking and other substances as a way to, you know, cope with that.
Right.
You know, but I've run into the similar thing too. I don't necessarily think it's intimidating, but at the same time, I can recognize when I'm around people who grew up with a childhood that they didn't have to recover from, you know,
yeah.
And it's, and I think that's an important distinction, because it is really, you know, in a lot of AA, it is a, you know, this disease can be considered hereditary in a lot of ways, you know, and we see that, you know, we grew up in ways that, you know, maybe it might have been alcohol was prevalent or different, you know, different things, but we do, we're able to overcome all that and be a force of good in the world. You know, we talk about the, you know, working through the steps, and we get to step 12. We practice these principles in all of our affairs, right, which means for being such a tiny little contingent of the global society, just through our good deeds and just through our, you know, living a program, you know, living a life of rigorous honesty, yeah, we're able to have a ripple effect.
Sure.
And we start to be a, you know, start to be someone who's, you know, basically, you know, I am a total stranger to how I used to be, yeah, you know, and if I ran into myself, you know, 15, 20 years ago, how I used to be versus, yeah, who I, you know, the man I turn into today, I'd say no effing way. You know, there's no way, right, that I'd be, you know, be able to do that. And it's, you know, and what a miracle.
Yeah. Well, you just said it, man. That is a miracle.
It really is. I mean, I look at, you know, and this is one of the things of like social media that is really, it is a tool, but I have a, you know, I go on Facebook and it has this thing called Facebook Memories, and I've been on Facebook for quite some time, and it will dig up comments that I made when I was still in active addiction. And I'm like, what a jerk. Like, I look at it, I couldn't even believe that I wrote that. I remember writing it. Right. And then it's kind of like puts me in the mindset that I was in back then, and just like an angry, hateful, spiteful person.
Right.
And that's how it is with those character defects. You know, when we're living from that, it is really it's kind of upsetting, kind of sad, you know, but at the same time, what a wonderful, you know, what a wonderful signpost to see how far we've come and how far we've healed and how far we've evolved as a result of working this program.
I think it's also important to remember that you know, when you mentioned the Facebook you know, a look back at your history and the things that we've posted in the past, that, you know, it's important to stay in the present, man. Because all we really have is right now, in this moment.
Right.
All we have is this conversation. And when this is done, I'm going to move on to my the rest of my day and do whatever. But in this moment, I can enjoy it. As you know, like I told you, I wanted to do this.
Right.
I was excited to do this. And I think it's one of the coolest things is to get a message out, a message of love, of tolerance, of peace, of hope. You know, all the good things that I didn't know I wanted, that I want today. And in wanting them, I want to give it away as well. You know what I mean?
You have to. I mean, it's one of the contradictions of AA. And that's one of the things I love about recovery is how much of our just like approach is contradictory. You know, give it away to keep it, surrender to win. Like these things, it doesn't make sense. No, but until you do it.
Right.
And we do have to give it away to keep it because that keeps you in the, you know, keeps you in the flow of things.
Sure, sure.
And it's just really, you know, it's important to be able to do that. You know, we practice these principles in all of our affairs. We really do. And it's really... you know, I think it's great how we, you know, follow God's will through different things. Like you had mentioned, we were talking earlier this week, and you had mentioned you'd come back up here. You had a grandchild, and it's, you know, and I understand one part of you really misses living down island. Obviously, you know, tropical environment. Now you're, in, you know, Cleveland, Ohio, where we just had one of the coldest winters. I mean, you live in a place that the air hurts your face. You know, you go outside in mid-February and it's like, you know, negative whatever, not to mention the wind chill. I mean, we had so much ice on the lake. It was frozen as far out all the way to the horizon, just white, frozen wasteland all the way out on the lake. And living in a place where the air hurts your face, knowing, you know, and you know what it's like when you're down, you know, down in the tropics and it's, you know,
it's
beautiful.
Perpetual summer.
Right. The thing is you're exactly where you need to be. And being able to accept that is really, you know, that's a big part of our program too, you know, accepting things.
Right. You know, I'll tell you a story. When my whole life was falling apart down there, I hit my knees. I was, I don't know if I want to share this, but I've shared it before. I was having an affair on my wife at the time, and I didn't know what to do because I wanted to be in the comfort of my old ways with this girl that I was messing around with, but I also wanted the structure in the that level of society and you know, righteousness, upstanding, you know, that my wife had. And I was torn between the old me and the me I wanted to be. And I would hit my knees because I was in the program. I wasn't doing the work, but I was trying to follow some suggestions, and I would hit my knees and I would pray and I would be like, God, put me where you want me, you know, just your will be done. And every time I do that, this girl would call me, the one I was messing around with. And I'm like, man, that did not make sense to me. Cause every time I said that prayer, you know, she would call me, not my wife. Right. So I'm like, something's wrong here. And I brought that up to my dad years later. And he said, Rich, you know, God's not the only one listening to your prayers. And I'm like, you know, referring to the devil.
Right. Right. Shaitan. Sure.
And I'm thinking about that. And I really did not want to give the devil that much credit. So I started thinking about it and thinking about it. And then I heard somebody say, God will use your defects to put you where he wants you. You know?
Right.
So I find myself in a place I don't want to be in. You know, the thing that keeps me here is my kids. I love my kids very much, but and my grandkids. And I love Alcoholics Anonymous because it changed the way I think, the way I live. It changed my life. So, you know, by removing me from all of that distraction, all of that material stuff, and putting me here where I can find a true spiritual path, where I can be effective, where I can be helpful, where I can have, you know, purpose. That life was selfish and self-centered as much as, you know, I wanted, right? I wanted to be part of that social environment. I wanted the beauty. I wanted the comfort. I wanted. So it was a selfish way of living. We're here. I have to sacrifice that selfishness. I have to sacrifice. You know, they say that, you know, our program is not thinking less of ourself, but thinking of ourself less.
Right.
Right? So that's what I'm finding. I'm getting all this spiritual, all these spiritual tools and all this good that is not material. It's all spiritual. It's all mental. If you'd have told me years ago, 20 years ago, that the spiritual, I wouldn't have believed you. If you told me that the spiritual outweighs the material, I wouldn't have believed it. I couldn't believe it. But today, I believe it more than anything else, that the spiritual is way more important than the
Let's unpack that a little bit. Because it sounds like you're talking a lot about a spiritual awakening, which is one of the 12, you know, what we have with 12, step 12. Okay, so when you came to this realization that, like, the spiritual was a lot more real than the, you know, the physical realm, what, I mean, was it like a sudden wake, you woke up one day and it was like a sudden, like, poof, revelation, so to speak, or was it more of a slow awakening?
Sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly.
Right, right.
I had both. I had two spiritual experiences, and my spiritual awakening was over a period of time. It was gradual. And really, the only way I can see it is to look back at my life and see how it developed into what it is today. However, the two experiences that I experienced were completely sober, no drugs involved. I was in the ocean. It was a white sand beach submerged in 3 feet of water, and then there was a rocky shoreline, but it was clear white sand in the water, and I'm standing there up to my waist in water, and I'm in salt water. And this feeling came over me. It was overwhelming. It was like a connectedness to everything, you know? It was like maybe, I don't know, I like to think it was God just touched me. It's just a little touch. I got a little bit of that, right?
Right.
And I only experienced it one time, and that was there. And it was easy to say, well, it was because I was in the islands, I was in this paradise place, and I just took it all in, and it felt good. But it wasn't like that, because I felt that the first time I got there. It was something else. It was something deeper. And but I could still attribute it to that. The second time, I was in Ohio, I was on my bike, and I had somebody on the bike with me. And I felt it again, that exact same feeling. I felt it again, like God touched me. Like, you're where you're supposed to be. And I was like, So those two experiences, all that did was gave me some like concrete footing to move in that direction. And I've been moving in that direction ever since. But they were so intense, it's like, I don't know that I can feel it, you know. I don't know how to explain this. It's like if, when you do something for the first time, it's way more intense. If you do it for the first time, it's really intense. And then if you keep doing it, that intensity diminishes, right?
Right.
Okay. So it's kind of like that. Like I experienced a spiritual thing, and in pursuit of it, it's just diminished to the point where it is what it is. It's like as solid as this table, you know? So I don't know if that made any sense. Did that make sense to you?
It did. You can't. The thing is, like with spiritual experiences, it's something that's outside of our control. Like it's the one thing, you know, I feel like, especially out of all the steps, if you look at everything else that you do, you know, it's taking an inventory, turning your will and life over, character defects, everything you do gets you a result.
Right.
Okay, until that spiritual experience isn't something that we could produce on our own because it's spiritual.
Right.
The only one, you know, God gives it to us and it happens in divine time.
Mm.
So I think it's like one of those things like you experience it, but you're not going to be able to chase it. You're not going to be able to recreate it because it's not something that you did. It's something that,
right,
came from your higher
divine,
power.
Divine,
so,
right.
It came from Allah. So
right.
It's really, you know, that's how I think it's. So it does make sense, but at the same time, it's something, you know, something absolutely infinite and beautiful touches us.
Right.
Touches us. And it's really, you know, I was talking with one of my Muslim brothers about this the other day about Ramadan. We have the holy month of Ramadan, and we fast all month, and it's a holy month, and it's a time where Allah opens the gates of Jannah, which we consider heaven, closes the gates of hell, and all of the devils, everyone's chained up for the month, and there's a. It's a month of fast. You know, we fast every day, and it is a month of a spiritual. I mean, just the vibe during Ramadan.
What
amazing.
Month is this?
It's Ramadan. It's it's on the Islamic calendar. It's the name of one of the months.
What is the what? Where does it fall in the regular calendar?
It moves because it's on a lunar calendar, so it changes every year.
Oh,
it moves a little closer. Like this year happened while the time change was happening, which was a little bit of a challenge when you're fasting, because we change the clocks a little bit,
right.
So it just adds to the challenge. But the point is, it's like the vibe of the month. It's you feel like the sense of spiritual connection. And it's one of those things that you don't I didn't even realize it again this year until it was over. And then you miss it. You're like, oh, man, I missed that. You know, it's that sense of that sense of connection during the entire month. And part of me, it's weird because it's Ramadan really it shakes up like the worldly physical side of myself sees it as a grind because it is like fasting every day. It turns into a grind. It really does. And it's really not there's aspects of it depending on my disposition or attitude where it's not very pleasant. But my higher self, the spiritually attuned part of myself, absolutely loves it.
Right.
You know, because I fast from a lot of things. I don't play video games. I don't watch TV. I don't do anything that I would normally distract myself with. I'm I'm reading my Quran. I'm reading works of scholars. I'm doing really just indulging myself in spiritually rewarding pursuits. Which is as a good Muslim, it's something I should be doing all the time. I'm human. I'm American Muslim too, so it's we fall into it's not I'm not perfect.
Right.
However, during Ramadan, it's an opportunity where I'm like, okay, this is really and it's a really beautiful time.
Well, it's interesting that you bring it up because fasting has been on my mind a lot. You know, it's something that I need to do. I started thinking about it as a way to lose weight. And get myself healthier, And I've been dragging my feet on making that commitment to do the fast that I want to do. And it keeps coming up. And that the fact that it does keep coming up, and the fact that, you know, I wasn't planning on talking about it today, but you never know
what's going to pop up.
Right. So it's like, it just tells me that I really need to make a commitment and do it.
Just try it. I mean, the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, would fast quite a bit. He would fast on Mondays, on Thursdays, and he was very used to fast quite often. Even when he did eat, it was never a lot. I gotta think of the exact. He would sit on the ground, and as he would eat, he had his leg up in front of his, like, kind of sitting on the ground with his leg bent in front of him. And when his stomach reached where his leg was, he knew he was done.
Yeah.
Knew he was done eating. So he would take as little as he could. He would eat very, very sparingly.
That's the
example of the Prophet, peace be upon him.
Sure.
But when it comes to, like, fasting, it's just start with a day. Just do it one day. You don't have to do like any, you know.
I've done the intermittent fasting.
Right.
You know, where you don't eat, I haven't eaten anything, you know, you don't eat anything for the whole day except for within a couple of hours. Right. But the fast that I want to do is, it involves smoking. You know, I want to give that up.
Oh.
And I won't, I'm not ready to yet. But
to quit smoking with cigarettes.
Yeah.
You just do it. I mean, look, I'm a former smoker. That's why I'm the worst kind of non-smoker, because I'm an ex-smoker, so I can smell it. I'm freaking obnoxious about it. I don't love smoking.
I'm afraid that's the
kind of thing. No, it's really, I struggled with cigarettes for a long, long time. And I finally quit I don't think I've had a cigarette since 2013. Oh, and nice. It's just really, you just got to do it. Just cold turkey.
Like, it's the way my dad did it. It's the way my stepdad did it. They're both just done.
Well, it's not, it's a lot different than being addicted to like alcohol. Okay. Because it's with cigarettes, like with me, you just have to overcome one craving at a time. And the cravings only last like 5 minutes. So it's just really, and the thing is the cravings space out more and more, but it's the same thing. Like if you could get through the first 3 days, you're fine. Mm-hmm. And I found that it's, you know, get over the cravings. For whatever reason, drinking cranberry juice helps.
Mm.
You know, and just do something, you know, chew gum, do some other things. And you got to start in the morning too. Like some people, they'll try to quit smoking and they'll wake up, after I had my first cigarette of the day, then I'm not, no. Just you had your first, last cigarette the night before. Because when you wake up, you already have an 8-hour head start out of that 3 days.
Sure. Yeah.
But I switched over. I did, cigarettes and I vaped for a couple of years. Mm-hmm. And it was really, the vaping was really, it was hard to transition from cigarettes to vaping because there's other things in cigarettes besides the nicotine that your body gets addicted to. They put the freebase nicotine in cigarettes. That's why it hits you so quickly. Mm-hmm. And there's other things. But once I got to the vaping, then it was easy to wean off with the, because it was like you can regulate the percentage of nicotine that's in the vape juice. So
right.
It was a lot easier to, you know, a lot easier to quit.
Yeah, well, you know, that's the next thing on my list, I think. And we're not perfect, but we just try and be better. And
right on. All right, well, Mr. Rich, listen, we're getting down to the end of the getting close to the end of the episode. Do you have any a message for our listeners, maybe anyone who's like feels spiritually dry or maybe trapped by routine right now that might benefit them?
Did we even talk about routine?
More or less, yeah, we got into it. I mean, the whole thing was a routine. But do you have any parting shots? Anything you want to leave with our?
I think what led to our discussion initially was, you know, people feeling trapped in life. You know, you got to go to work, you got to do the drudgery, the humdrum. I think that if you're in that position, pray for guidance. You know, I read this morning that contemplation is the greatest form of prayer. You know, I was on track to be a commercial artist, and I realized that that wasn't for me. It hampered my freedom to create. It impeded my ability to create because I have to create this thing that this large corporation wants me to create. And it's like I have to work within boundaries, you know, and that's not how I work. I need that freedom to spread out and pull from different places, unconventional like. And I think that's how life has to be, for me anyway. It has to be, well, it has been, and it will probably continue to be unconventional as far as society's concerned. Start small. You know, we were just talking about me quitting smoking. You know, trying to extract yourself from a system that, and I'm not talking about, you know, any kind of weird, you know, rebellious anything, but if you find yourself in a place that you don't like, one step at a time, stay in the moment, try and be a better person today than you were yesterday, talk to people, you know, ask for suggestions. You know, you offered several that I've heard 100 times as far as trying to quit smoking. So, but don't give up. Don't give up. You know, continue to work or continue to pursue something greater than yourself, whether that be God, Allah, or whatever other deities, you know, might be available.
Right. It's God of your understanding. It's one exactly. of those aspects of recovery.
Right.
Okay. The last thing we usually do is I always ask my guests for a book recommendation.
Book recommendation?
Yeah. What have you got?
The Celestine Prophecy by James Redfield.
James Redfield. Okay. Celestine Prophecy. Okay. Why? We got a couple minutes left. Any particular reason?
Yeah. Because that book helped me extremely deal with other people. It helped me understand other people. It helped me find empathy for other people. And I think that's important in a spiritual way. When you start to understand how people want energy from you, you know, and the ways people go about it, it's just a really good, really good book.
I read it. I think it was 18 when I read it. A long time ago. That's weird. I thought you were going to go with Sermon on the Mount. So
well, that one too.
Yeah, I'm kind of surprised with James Redfield out of left field.
Twister.
All right, Rich, I'd like to thank you for being with us today. I mean, this was an absolutely amazing experience. Thank you. Thanks everyone for listening today. Just remember, if you guys are struggling, please, 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 please pick up the phone before you pick up the bottle. Okay, make that phone call. Just don't, you know, make a good decision. Make a good decision, folks. Please make a good decision. All right, everyone, that's a wrap for this week. We will catch y'all next Monday, with a new episode, inshallah. And thank you, everyone, for tuning in to another episode of Path of the Sober Seeker. Thank you. Bye-bye.